Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, July 19th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. The Courier is forecasting a nice day, and it will be mostly sunny, with a high of 87 degrees. Winds from the north between 3 and 6 miles per hour. We'll have a clear night with a low of 65 degrees, west-northwest winds 2 to 4 miles per hour. We see three articles on the front page: Navigating the Waste Stream, What New Permitless Carry Law Does and Doesn't Allow, and we'll begin with Party On, GB PAC Bringing the Noise, Gallagher Blue Dorn Block Parties to Continue This Summer and Fall. Story file by Melody Parker, and begins with a photograph of Kevin Burt, who will perform in the Orange neighborhood at Lichty Park for residents on Friday. Cedar Falls. Seven neighborhoods in Waterloo and Cedar Falls will be treated to free block parties through the remainder of the summer and fall. The Kevin Burt Trio will perform in the Orange neighborhood at Lichty Park for residents on Friday. Music is from 7 to 10 p.m. One of several neighborhoods where the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center is taking its portable stage, sound and lighting for a series of Gallagher Blue Dorn block parties. The center also provides staff to run the equipment. Quote, for some of the neighborhoods we're working with, it's the first time residents have gathered together like this. It's really such a fun event, and everyone has a good time, said GB PAC Executive Director Stephen Kerrigan. Block parties, which began in May, are an outgrowth of the popular Gallagher Blue Dorn Local Legends music series that was live streamed from the Great Hall stage during the pandemic. As relationships grew and strengthened between local artists and the Performing Arts Center, and as the center developed and expanded its capacity to host outdoor events, the idea to flip the concert project outward and serve people where they live seemed like a natural move, Kerrigan said. The last block party is September 26, but plans already are being made for more events next spring. The Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa provided a grant so block parties are free of charge. Gallagher Blue Dorn is collaborating directly with neighborhood associations and organizers. Quote, we found there was a lot of appetite for these kind of neighborhood gatherings, Kerrigan explained. The block party can be a standalone event, but some neighborhoods have tied it to other planned events, fests, or activities. In addition, the center has partnered with Waterloo Center for the Arts and Hearst Center for the Arts to offer art activities for children. Quote, what I like about this live music event is that it provides an anchor for other stuff, said Kerrigan, such as food trucks or vendors and public health outreach. People were isolated by COVID, but with the easing of restrictions, quote, there is a renewed desire for neighbors to get to know each other, have face-to-face conversations, forge relationships, and be respectful to one another, he explained. Quote, what is meaningful in our day-to-day lives is much more focused when we are talking about the neighborhood where we live, unquote. Here is the list of upcoming block parties. Friday, 7 to 10 p.m., is the Kevin Burt Trio in the Orange neighborhood, Lichty Park, Side Hill and Grace Drives in Waterloo. On next Sunday, 4 to 7 p.m., nevertheless, Maywood Park, Schultz Street, Waterloo. August 22nd, 4 to 7 p.m., Tim and the True Tones, Kingsley neighborhood, Barnes Park, Waterloo. August 27th, 7 to 10 p.m., Stack House, North Cedar, Eagles Club, 2125 West Lone Tree Road, Cedar Falls. August 29th, 4 to 7 p.m., Windsong Church Row Neighborhood, Washington Park, Waterloo. September 24th, 7 to 10 p.m., Limestoners, Highland Park Neighborhood, Park in the Center of Neighborhood, Waterloo. September 26th, 4 to 7 p.m., Limestoners and Snosberries, Liberty Park Neighborhood, Morris Park, next to Kittrell Elementary School, Waterloo. Our next story was filed by Melody Parker. Cedar River Festival Group dredges up 34 years worth of trash and debris. We opened with a photograph of some of that debris in the river. What we're looking at is a close-up of one of those plastic holders for cans, and it's up against a rock in the river. Lots of tires, appliances, mattresses, and a toilet are among the items that have been fished out of the Cedar River over the years. On Saturday, volunteers for the Cedar River Festival Group will climb into canoes again for the 34th time to pick up trash and debris. Quote, "It's actually Iowa's longest-running river cleanup," said Kristen Guess, a board member with the organization. The goals continue to include safely cleaning up the river, raising awareness, and advocating for preserving water. Volunteers will meet at 8 a.m. at Deerwood Park in Evansdale for registration and a safety meeting. They'll be bused to the starting point of the cleanup route, Guest said, and paddle the 3 miles or so back to Deerwood Park, picking up debris along the way. Many participants bring canoes, but canoes are available for volunteers if they don't have one. People are encouraged to sign up in advance at the Cedar River Festival Group's Facebook page to make sure we have enough canoes for everyone. If someone has their own canoe or kayak, we encourage them to bring that. We have some people come to help who have never paddled on the river before, she said. Life jackets are provided. Participants should bring bug repellent, sunscreen, and bottled water. Trash bags are provided by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Guess, who has been involved in the cleanup for 10 years, encourages each canoe group to choose their favorite piece of trash. At the end, a vote is taken to name the most unusual or unique piece. A toilet won 2 years ago, but typically we pull tons of tires out of the river every year, and we've seen car parts, bicycles, random metal pieces, lots of bottles and cans. Each year there is at least one mattress. We recycle as much as we can, she noted. Generally, it amounts to 3 or 4 hours on the water. Lunch is provided at the end of the route. On Sunday, a music festival will celebrate the cleanup from noon to 7 p.m. at Gateway Park in Cedar Falls. The public may attend free of charge. Featured bands are Uncle Chuck and Friends, Walking Dead Zeppelin, Rush Cleveland Trio, 3O, and Raldo and Friends. Locale food truck will be at the park as well as craft vendors. Interested vendors still have time to sign up to sell their wares. Festival t-shirts designed by Samantha Gipper will be sold to raise funds for the festival. Now a story about the gun permit law, story filed by Amy Rivers. What new permitless carry law does and doesn't allow. Waterloo. Tony Thompson didn't want to anger the barber holding clippers to his scalp, but he knew he was hearing a common misconception about Iowa's new gun law. Thompson listened silently as his barber mentioned getting arrested for an operating while intoxicated charge while he had a handgun in his glove box, a no-no even with a permit, Thompson said. Quote, "So now he's a felon and he can't carry," but he said, "I'm just going to wait until constitutional carry goes into effect, and then I'll be good," said Thompson. Black Hawk County Sheriff, "I'm like, that's not the way it works," unquote. Under the law approved by the Republican-controlled legislature that took effect July 1st, people purchasing pistols or revolvers no longer need to obtain permits to acquire or carry handguns, a process that could take days as a background check is completed. They must still pass an instant federal background check to buy handguns at retailers, but face no such requirement if buying through private sellers. They will not need a permit to carry guns on themselves or in their cars in most places, including the Iowa Capitol, and they no longer need to take an online training course on gun safety and self-defense. But Iowa's new permitless carry law doesn't change existing laws about who can't carry a weapon, Thompson said. If you've been convicted of a felony or domestic abuse charge, or you've been involuntarily hospitalized for mental illness, or you're under 21, or if you're under the influence of alcohol or drugs, you're still not allowed to have a weapon on you or in your car. What it does change, according to the bill that the governor signed earlier this year, is that everyone else no longer has to obtain a permit from their county sheriff's office, though they still can, and they can carry a gun openly or concealed. Carrying weapons without a permit is no longer illegal. That's something around 600 Iowans each year previously were arrested for, according to the Associated Press. Second Amendment aficionados call it part of constitutional carry, pointing to that amendment's right to bear arms, and language noting that the right shall not be infringed as reasons to relax gun laws nationwide. But the new law also comes amid a national surge in gun homicides in 2020 that Iowa wasn't immune to. A record 353 Iowans died from gunshot wounds in 2020, 263 of them suicides, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. That's a 23% increase from 287 such deaths in 2019, Iowa's previous record. The new law has affected gun sales locally, as new laws regarding guns usually do, said Mike Rostek, who owns Mr. Guns in Cedar Falls. Quote, to me, it'll be a temporary surge, but you don't know, he said, noting handguns are his most popular sellers. Under the law, Iowans buying a gun from a federally licensed dealer still have to either pass a federal background check or present a permit to carry. That makes it work more for us unless the purchaser already has a permit, Rostek said. But he said it was similar to a layaway for those whose background check came up inconclusive. Wait 5 days or so and come back when the check has cleared. Quote, some of them don't understand why they can't get their gun right now. But that's the law, and that's how it works, he said. Overall, Rostek said he thought the law was a good idea. It kind of shifts the liability back to the federal government, and they can blame themselves if they don't do the check right, Rostek said. Thompson, who is also the president of the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association, said he thinks the new law also shifts liability back onto the general population. If people are carrying guns illegally, he said, they can still be arrested on a felony charge. Quote, what I don't want to have happen is my constituents to get arrested for absent-mindedly doing something against the law or doing something that they didn't realize was against the law simply because they made an assumption that it was okay and it's not, Thompson said. The onus also shifts more onto law enforcement in a post-Ferguson, post-George Floyd world that has changed the calculus of stops for many in law enforcement, Thompson said. Is this going to add scrutiny? Am I a good guy or a bad guy? I'm less likely to get scrutiny if I'm taking a gun-toting bad guy, he said of his deputies. Some, like the Gazette's Adam Sullivan, have argued the law, just like changing Iowa's permit law to, quote, shall issue in 2011, will result in a more equitable justice system. Quote, under previous law, black Iowans were convicted of acquiring or carrying a gun without a permit at about 7 times the rate as the total population, Sullivan wrote, citing a national ACLU study. He called Iowa's former gun permitting system, quote, a relic of our racist history, meant to give law enforcement officials control over who's allowed to have a gun, unquote. But with the power to decide who to question about carrying a gun now firmly up to the state's law enforcement, reducing that disparity isn't so simple, said Thompson. Quote, I don't know if it'll go away. It should lessen the margin, he said. Quote, as much as I would like you to believe that criminalistics is a blind process, we know statistically that's not true, unquote. Thompson said those who have felony domestic assault or mental adjudication on their records can apply for clemency, though it's a tedious process if they want to carry guns. But he also cautioned that carrying a gun for increased protection is a misnomer, not reflected in gun theft, homicide, and suicide statistics. Quote, equating that weapons possession to, quote, I am going to be safer because of it. A lot of those folks are going to end up being victims because of that wrongful mentality, Thompson said. Quote, and then we've got more guns on the street possessed by bad guys, unquote. Next, Space Jam dunks on Black Widow to take box office number one, filed by the Associated Press. Black Widow ceded its number one spot to an unlikely foe in its second week in theaters, the Toon Squad. LeBron James, Bugs Bunny, and the rest of the stars of Warner Brothers' Space Jam, A New Legacy, defied expectations and won the box office this weekend. According to studio estimates Sunday, Space Jam, A New Legacy, grossed $31.7 million in North America, while Black Widow took in $26.3 million. Not many expected Space Jam, A New Legacy, to pull off this win. The poorly reviewed film was pegged for an opening in the $20 million range, but a sizable number of families and millennials who grew up with the original Space Jam left the house and went to theaters to see it, even though it's currently streaming on HBO Max, free for subscribers. Not only that, audiences also gave the film a promising A-minus cinema score, suggesting word of mouth could be wrong. Space Jam, A New Legacy, is the largest pandemic opening for Warner Brothers, which is significant since the studio in 2021 is releasing all its films simultaneously in theaters and on HBO Max. It's also the largest domestic opening for a family film since the beginning of the pandemic. Warner Brothers said 32% of the audience was under 18, which is larger than usual. Most of the major family films that have come out during the pandemic, from The Boss Baby: Family Business to Raya, The Last Dragon, have opened well under $20 million, but audiences of all ages turned out for the new Space Jam. It shows that families have waited for a movie that everyone can go to and enjoy. That's this movie, said Jeff Goldstein, Warner Brothers' head of domestic distribution. Quote, it's just a fun movie for the family, unquote. Black Widow, meanwhile, fell 67% in its second week, which, although steep, is also fairly normal for superhero films, which tend to have front-loaded audiences. Internationally, the Scarlett Johansson-led film picked up another $29.9 million, bringing its global gross to $264 million. Last weekend, Black Widow became the highest-grossing film of the pandemic. Disney also surprised many in the industry by revealing its first weekend profits from the movie's streaming rentals. Rental grosses were not provided this week, however. This weekend saw the launch of Escape Room: Tournament of Champions, a sequel to the high-concept 2019 film. Sony projected that the film would gross $8.8 million over the weekend, which is actually better than the first film's debut and in line with studio expectations. F9 took fourth place with $7.6 million. The Fast and Furious film has made $591.2 million globally to date. The fifth and sixth place spots also went to Universal Films. The Boss Baby: Family Business with $4.7 million and The Forever Purge with $4.1 million. A Quiet Place Part 2, which recently became available on Paramount Plus, is still doing good numbers into its eighth week in theaters. It added another $2.3 million, bringing its domestic total to $155 million. The Anthony Bourdain documentary, Roadrunner, also did well this weekend, grossing around $1.9 million from 925 theaters, making it the top-grossing specialty debut of the year. Now we turn the page to the Cedar Valley section. Cowboys for Christ, filed by Jared McNett of the Globe Gazette. Earlier this month, Mike and Jamie Reichertz were dealt a bit of a blow by the Charles City Council. Its five members voted 3-2 against the Green couple's plan to house four mules on property near the northern edge of town. For years now, the couple has used mules for their ongoing cowboy Christian ministry, part of the Cowboys for Christ movement that's taken them to at least six states. They hoped to keep their mules on about 10 acres of fenced-in land at Charles City. Mike says it's a slight setback. Being touched by God encourages you to continue on, he's fond of saying. Mike said it took a while after he was saved, or touched by God, before the cowboy ministry fell into place, but it eventually became the most important part of their lives. Jamie and Mike will ride into a state park on their mules, because Jamie is allergic to horses, and pass out flyers for a non-denominational Sunday service. Mike preaches and Jamie plays guitar. Some days that means hoofing it as much as 10 miles to reach every campsite at a park to extend the invitation. Quote, there are a lot of campsites you'll walk into and invite them, and they'll say, no, thank you. Others will want you to get out as quick as possible. They're not always nice, but that's not for me to decide, Mike said. I've never had problems with park rangers, and if I see one, I invite them to the service. A park ranger at Yellow River State Forest told him that he wished the Reichertz would come back every weekend. Quote, he said the people who are godly people are much kinder, much nicer, and keep their camp clean, Mike said. Cowboys for Christ was founded in 1970, according to its website, to reach out to the livestock industry worldwide. Based in Fort Worth, Texas, it actually ordains cowboy and cowgirl chaplains and put out a 16-page publication called The Christian Ranchman that contains letters, testimonials, and articles from folks all around the country. On the kitchen table at their home outside of Green, Jim and Mike have the latest edition, as well as flipbooks they hand out before Sunday services. A sign above a door in the kitchen says, This Day the Lord Made. In the living room, Jamie has mounted a puzzle that shows Jesus about to hop onto a white horse. To Jamie, the toughest days are when they pass out all sorts of flyers and no one shows up. Quote, that's probably the hardest, and financially, it's out of our pocket. Otherwise, it's fun. We love to camp, and we love to ride, Jamie said. The mules themselves actually aren't such a pain. Mike said he actually trained one to answer questions. Quote, we use it for kids to close out vacation Bible schools. The kids would ask us questions, and I would cue it to shake its head yes or no, Mike said. Jamie pointed out that the mules are a bit better for their ministry work because they're more sure-footed than horses. The greatest joy in their work? All of it. When someone needs prayer and we pray with them, that's fun too, Jamie said. Being there with people, talking with them, praying for them, Mike said. Jamie and Mike try to go out at least twice a month to ride and witness. She said every year they go to southern Illinois for a mule ride that one year had about 800 mules in attendance. Quote, we did the cowboy church there two different Sundays, Mike said. When he's not going to major mule gatherings, riding, or witnessing, Mike works as a self-employed contractor, or jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none, as he called it. He enjoys the work and is thankful it affords him a chance to continue his ministry with his wife. It's work they don't plan on stopping anytime soon. Quote, I enjoy what I do, so I just keep doing it, Mike said. Next is a story filed by Amy Rivers. Daycare, Senior Activity Center planned. Facilities proposed on 32 acres as part of North Crossing area. Waterloo. A new daycare and senior activity center are one step closer to being built on the city's north side. The two centers would be built on 32 acres of city land at 501 Lakeside Street, east of East 4th Street, and two blocks north of East Donald Street, within the North Crossing area, according to documents presented at Tuesday's Planning, Programming, and Zoning Commission. The daycare facility is proposed for the southern portion of the lot, while the senior activity center would be built on the northern portion. Additional area would be available for future development. The area would need to be rezoned from A1 and R2 to R4, which would allow for the centers to be built if approved by City Council. In conjunction with the request was a plan for sidewalks to be installed on both sides of East 4th Street, as well as internal connection to the existing North Crossing development to the west. North Crossing will develop the area in conjunction with the city, according to Noel Anderson, Community Planning and Development Director. Quote, "What we have in this area is interest with several parties looking to do development," said Alex Bauer, project coordinator with Robinson Engineering of Independence, the consulting firm working on North Crossing. He said the two facilities were needed in the area. Quote, "We were looking for a place to provide daycare opportunities for families in the area. The senior activity center, which would pair with the hospital nearby, and then some other opportunities for housing," Bauer said. Neighbors on nearby Lakeside, Homer, and Nile Streets, some of whom mentioned water and drainage issues, asked about the project's stormwater retention. Bauer said a lot of the North Crossing area would drain into a regional detention pond north of Homer and Nile Streets. Quote, "The good news is that the area is already lower than surrounding houses," Bauer said. Helen Seenster, who lives on Homer Street, asked when construction might begin. Anderson said it was scheduled for this fall or winter. Quote, "I think this is an excellent development on our side of Waterloo," Seenster said. "It's a good opportunity to develop that land out there," unquote. Cedar Falls Schools to use stimulus funds to support students and staff. Filed by Andrew Wind, Cedar Falls. Cedar Falls Community Schools is planning some extra supports funded with federal stimulus dollars to help students who have struggled academically due to COVID-19 disruptions. Superintendent Andy Petty detailed some plans to the Board of Education last week for using the $3.99 million received by the district in the third round of elementary and secondary school emergency fund relief. The aid is part of the American Rescue Plan signed into law March 11th. Quote, "There are dollars that have been allocated to kind of closing the gap, the learning or sometimes the lack of learning that took place across the nation during the pandemic," said Petty. Federal rules require districts to spend at least 20% of their total allocation addressing learning loss. Quote, "We are using some of our dollars to focus on interventionists," he said. Expanding these positions will help district educators to really look at skill deficiencies in students so we can help enhance the education of all our students pre-K to 12. Quote, "Another area that we're continuing to look at focusing on is extended learning time via one-to-one tutoring, before and after school assistance, credit recovery, and different summer school options." The district was ramping up summer school a little bit this year, but it's going to be much more targeted as we look into the future, unquote. Money is also being spent on supplies and equipment for sanitation, maintaining air quality, and other mitigation strategies, along with staff professional development on adapting to keep people safe from the coronavirus. ESSER dollars will support students and staff as well, whose mental health was adversely affected by the pandemic. In addition, the district's professional learning communities will be supported by the funding as schools go back to fully implementing those staff working groups. Quote, "That's something that we had to take a step back on," said Petit, as the district used protocols to keep the virus from spreading in schools. Quote, "We've got a lot of focus on how we build back to pre-pandemic," unquote. Petit acknowledged the limits of the amount of federal ESSER money received by the district. Quote, "In this day and age, that doesn't go as far as we hoped," unquote, he said. "But we think our interventionists are going to be highly impactful with the work that they do paired with the instructional coaches, unquote. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, July 19th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's continue with more local news. Family mourns boy who died after Iowa water ride accident, filed by the Associated Press. Family and friends are remembering the joy an 11-year-old boy brought to others before he was critically injured on a ride at an Iowa amusement park earlier this month, and he died the next day. Many of the more than 100 mourners grieving Michael Jaramillo's death wore orange to his funeral in Des Moines on Saturday because it was his favorite color, according to the Des Moines Register. Jaramillo was injured July 3rd after a boat he was riding on with five other family members flipped over at Adventureland Park in Altoona and trapped the young boy and his older brother under the water for minutes. Michael Jaramillo died the next day, while 16-year-old David Jaramillo remains hospitalized in critical condition. Quote, "There's honestly nothing bad I can say about this young man, and there are very few people in this world I hold to that high standard of regard. Michael was just a kind, loving, gentle young man," Pastor Christian Shield said. Shield, who is the pastor at Christian Life Church, said he got to know Michael Jaramillo well over the past year and a half with his family from Marion, had worshipped at the church in Cedar Rapids. Jaramillo's cousin, Naya Petty, who was on the whitewater ride with him that day, said she will miss his laughter. Quote, "I hope you know how significant your presence is and how earthly you could be. Your laugh was contagious, and you smiled when you sang," said Petty, who read a poem she had written for her dead cousin at the funeral. Next, Logan Avenue shooting sends one man to hospital on Sunday. Story filed by Amy Rivers. Waterloo, a shooting along Logan Avenue near the Motel 6 sent one man to the hospital early Sunday morning. An adult male showed up at a local hospital with a gunshot wound early Sunday, according to police, who described the injury as not life-threatening. No other injuries were reported. Someone reported shots being fired just before 4 a.m. in the 2100 block of East 4th Street, though police said they didn't find anyone injured, damage, or bullet casings in the area. Police did, however, find a vehicle with damage, believed to be the victim's vehicle, and shell casings on Logan Avenue near the Motel 6 at 2343 Logan Avenue, about a mile and a half away. No one had been arrested as of Sunday morning. The incident was still being investigated, according to police. Here is a second story about that fatal accident at Adventureland. Woman says her boat had problems before Iowa ride accident. Filed by Ryan Foley of the Associated Press, and begins with a photograph of the entrance gate at Adventureland. A woman whose family went on an Iowa amusement ride shortly before an accident that killed an 11-year-old boy and critically injured his brother said Friday her boat also had problems floating properly and she felt unsafe. Amber Estrada, 31, said the boat carrying her and her husband, their three children, and nephew at times struck and dragged along the bottom of the man-made river on the Raging River ride at Adventureland Park in Altoona on July 3rd. She said the boat made a grinding sound that she could feel under her feet. Estrada of Eagle Grove said her husband told her that he felt scared and wanted to get off the ride. The couple made the decision to lean forward in their seats with their children because they worried it would tip over, she said. They were able to reach the end of the ride safely, but, quote, unfortunately, that did not happen to another family, she said. A boat carrying six members of the Jaramillo family of Marion capsized minutes later, trapping 11-year-old Michael Jaramillo and his now 16-year-old brother David in their seatbelts underneath the water for several minutes. Michael died of his injuries the next day. David remains in critical condition at Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines, unable to talk. family attorney Ryan Best said. Their father, also David Jaramillo, underwent a four-hour surgery Tuesday to repair broken bones in his shoulder, he said. Iowa inspectors are looking into what caused the boat to flip, and the ride has been shut down until the investigation is complete and hazards are corrected. A state report dated July 4th said that the Jaramillos' boat immediately began taking on water as the ride began and touched the bottom of the trough multiple times. Inspectors said they saw scrape marks on the trough's concrete bottom and gouges in wooden poles along the ride from the boat contact. The boat eventually overturned during the ride's final curve, according to the report, first reported by the Des Moines Register. Estrada said she saw the Jaramillos in line a few places behind her and witnessed emergency responders rushing to the scene after her family got off. She said she did not report her family's negative experience to Adventureland staff because her autistic son was upset about a stolen toy, and they left. Estrada said she has been on the ride many times and never experienced such problems. She said she later reached out to the Jaramillo family through their pastor and shared her experience with their lawyer Thursday. Quote, "My heart breaks for them," she said. "I think something needs to be done about this ride." Best said Estrada's account was consistent with what happened to the Jaramillos and suggests the boats were not properly floating on the day of the incident. "There was a broader problem," he said. Adventureland attorney Guy Cook said Friday that the park was unaware of Estrada's claims and that the investigation to date has found no such narrative. The senior operators have no reports of any difficulties with the boats from guests prior to the tragic accident, he said. Nevertheless, all information and reports will be considered as the investigation continues, unquote. The state report notes that the park's maintenance staff took the Jaramillo's boat and others out of service earlier that day due to rafts on boats deflating. Workers replaced the deflated bladders in the rafts before putting the boats back into service. Cook said each boat's raft has 8 bladders, and they are monitored and routinely taken out so they can be refilled with air or replaced if they get deflated. Quote, "There's nothing unusual about that," he said. He noted the Jaramillo's boat was found after the accident with only one of its bladders deflated and an exterior indentation on the outer rubber tube. He said the boats, which weigh 1,700 pounds and have a heavy metal plate on the bottom for ballast, would not flip due to a single deflated bladder, and it's not clear when its deflation occurred. Quote, "If you stay in your seat and the weight is evenly distributed, regardless of whether a bladder is fully inflated, it's very difficult to see how a 1,700-pound boat flips over," he said. "That's why it would appear that there was some other factor at work on this day," unquote. This is a story now about the virus outbreak. Surgeon General worried. As cases rise, Murthy urges unvaccinated Americans to get shots. Stories filed by the Associated Press. The U.S. Surgeon General said Sunday he's concerned about what lies ahead with cases of COVID-19 increasing in every state, millions still unvaccinated, and a highly contagious virus variant spreading rapidly, noting that nearly all coronavirus deaths now are among the tens of millions of people who haven't received shots, despite widespread vaccine availability. Dr. Vivek Murthy painted an unsettling picture of what the future could hold. Quote, "I am worried about what is to come, because we are seeing increasing cases among the unvaccinated in particular. And while if you are vaccinated, you are very well protected against hospitalization and death, unfortunately, that's not true if you're not vaccinated," Murthy said on CNN's State of the Union. U.S. cases of COVID-19 last week increased by 17,000 nationwide over a 14-day period for the first time since late fall. Much of the worsening problem is being driven by the Delta variant, first identified in India, Murthy said. Murthy said the worsening situation shows the need to convince more people to get inoculations. Quote, "It's our fastest, most effective way out of this pandemic, he said. About 186 million Americans have received at least one shot, but another 90 million eligible Americans haven't. In other news, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will spend 10 days self-isolating after contact with a confirmed coronavirus case, his office said Sunday, reversing an earlier announcement that he would not have to quarantine after facing an uproar. Tunisia's government deployed the armed forces to vaccinate people in regions with the worst infection rates and in areas with particularly low vaccination rate. The North African country is facing its worst coronavirus surge since the pandemic began. South Korea on Sunday sent a military aircraft to replace the entire 301-member crew of a Navy destroyer on an anti-piracy mission off East Africa after nearly 70 of them tested positive for the coronavirus, officials said. Our next story is filed by the Associated Press. The author is Matthew Lee. U.S. probes health issues among diplomats in Vienna, Washington. The Biden administration is investigating a recent rash of mysterious health incidents reported by American diplomats and other government employees in Vienna, Australia, U.S. officials said. Some of the symptoms are similar to those first reported by U.S. diplomats and spies in Havana, Cuba, in 2016 and 2017, for which no definitive cause has yet been determined. According to the officials, who said more than 20 new cases were being looked at by medical teams at the State Department and elsewhere, including the Pentagon and the CIA. Quote, in coordination with our partners across the U.S. government, we are vigorously investigating reports of possible unexplained health incidents among the U.S. Embassy Vienna community, the State Department said. Any employees who reported a possible UHI received immediate and appropriate attention and care, unquote. Some believe the unexplained injuries, which include brain damage, are the result of attacks with microwave or radio wave weapons. However, despite years of study, there is no consensus as to what or who might be behind the incidents or whether they are, in fact, attacks. The Vienna-based employees have reported suffering from mysterious symptoms since President Joe Biden was inaugurated, according to the officials. Vienna has for centuries been a center for espionage and diplomacy and was a hub for clandestine spy versus spy activity during the Cold War. The city is currently the site of indirect talks between Iran and the United States over salvaging the nuclear deal that was negotiated there in 2015. Those talks are now in hiatus, and it was not immediately clear if any members of the U.S. negotiating team were among those suffering from injuries. The problem has been labeled the Havana Syndrome because the first cases affected personnel in 2016 at the U.S. Embassy in Cuba. In May, officials said at least 130 cases across the government were under investigation, up from several dozen last year. People who are believed to have been affected have reported headaches, dizziness, and symptoms consistent with concussions, with some requiring months of medical treatment. Some have reported hearing a loud noise before the onset of symptoms. Particularly alarming are revelations of at least two possible incidents in the Washington area, including one case near the White House in November, in which an official reported dizziness. Although some are convinced the injuries are the result of directed energy attacks, others believe the growing number of cases could actually be linked to mass psychogenic illness, in which people learning of others with symptoms begin to feel sick themselves. Now here's the Digest column. Senator says bill loses IRS provision. Washington. A proposal to strengthen IRS enforcement to crack down on tax scofflaws and help fund a nearly $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure spending is officially off the table, Republican Senator Rob Portman said Sunday. Portman, who is involved in negotiating the bill, cited pushback from fellow Republican lawmakers who dislike the idea of expanding the reach of the IRS, which they have accused over the years of unfairly targeting conservatives. He said another reason the IRS provision was shelved is that Democrats are including a more robust enforcement plan in a separate $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill that they intend to pass through the Senate using special budget rules and without Republican votes. Oregon blaze grows as western fires persist. Bly, Oregon, the largest wildfire in the U.S., torched more than dry forest landscape in Oregon on Sunday, one of dozens of major blazes burning across the West as critically dangerous fire weather loomed in the coming days. The destructive bootleg fire just north of the California border grew to more than 476 square miles, an area about the size of Los Angeles. Erratic winds fed the blaze, creating dangerous conditions for firefighters, said Sarah Gracie, a spokeswoman for the firefighting operation. At the other end of the state, a fire in the mountains of northeast Oregon grew to more than 17 square miles by Sunday. Afghanistan. The leader of the Taliban said Sunday that his movement is committed to a political settlement to end decades of war in Afghanistan, even as the insurgents battle in dozens of districts across the country to gain territory. The statement by Malawi Habatullah Akhundzada came as Taliban leaders were meeting with a high-level Afghan government delegation in the Gulf state of Qatar to jumpstart stalled peace talks. Oil dispute. OPEC and allied nations agreed Sunday to raise the production limits imposed on five countries next year and boost their production by 2 million barrels per day by the end of this year, ending a dispute that roiled oil markets. In a statement Sunday, the cartel announced that Iraq, Kuwait, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE would see their limits rise. Cruising. Pandemic restrictions on Florida-based cruise ships will remain in place after a federal appeals court temporarily blocked a previous ruling that sided with a Florida lawsuit challenging the regulations. The decision by the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals was filed at 11:50 p.m. Saturday, just minutes before a Tampa judge's previous ruling on the restrictions was set to take effect. Thailand. Thai police used tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannons Sunday to disperse hundreds of anti-government protesters who held a rally in Bangkok, despite coronavirus restrictions banning gatherings of more than five people. India. At least 20 people were killed in a landslide triggered by heavy monsoon rains in the Indian city of Mumbai, officials said Sunday. Dozens of rescuers were clearing the debris in search of at least 15 other people who were likely trapped under the rubble. Outbreak. Two more Texas lawmakers who left their state to hobble efforts to pass new voting restrictions have tested positive for the coronavirus, raising to five the number of infected people in the delegation. A person familiar with the delegation said Sunday the number of infected members has risen to five. The person was not authorized to discuss the matter and requested anonymity. Turning to the sports page now, in professional golf, Visaki earns dramatic Waterloo Open victory. The story is filed by Craig Sisker and begins with a photograph with the caption, Michael Visaki of Sarasota, Florida, pumps his fist as he sinks a putt on the 18th green for the win in the professional tournament of the Waterloo Open on Sunday at Irv Warren Memorial Golf Course. Waterloo. Michael Visaki's lead was slipping away. Ahead by two shots, with a two par three holes remaining, he bogeyed number 17 and pulled his tee shot just to the left of the green on 18. But Vilsakis maintained his razor-sharp focus. His long chip from the fringe rolled 6 feet past the hole, but he drained a clutch putt, coming back to earn a dramatic one-shot win Sunday at the 88th Waterloo Open. He shot a final round 67, to hold off hard-charging Justin Huber to capture the championship and the $50,000 winner's paycheck at Irv Warren Memorial Golf Course. Quote, "It's an unbelievable feeling to win this," Kilsaki said. "This is one of my favorite events to play. I had finished fifth and sixth here in 2018 and 2019, so I had good memories of this golf course, and now I have another one." Visaki from Sarasota, Florida, finished the tournament with an impressive 23 under par total. He led after the first and second rounds of the 54-hole event, but he had his struggles on the front nine Sunday after missing numerous fairways. Visaki was able to scramble out of danger and managed to stay near the top of the leaderboard after shooting a 36 on the opening nine. During a 20-minute delay where Visaki waited as pace of play slowed while golfers played the drivable par 4 10th, he was able to regroup. He caught fire on the back nine, going eagle, birdie, eagle on holes 12 through 14. He nearly eagled 13. That pivotal stretch vaulted Visaki to 24 under par and into sole possession of first. It was a lead he would not relinquish. Quote, "I just had a different mental approach," Visaki said. "I knew I had to fire at some flagsticks. I was able to chip in from behind the green on 12. That gave me the confidence to continue to play well. I almost had the eagle on 13, but the putt flipped out. I needed to get it going, and luckily I was able to." Visaki gave a stroke back with the bogey on 17 before turning his attention to the final hole. Quote, "I just had to put that bogey behind me and hit the center of the green on 18, he said. "I pulled it a bit, but I knew I could still get up and down, and that's exactly what I did." Huber, from Ponte Verde Beach, Florida, grabbed the lead for much of the round Sunday as he shot a blistering 10-under-par round of 62. He collected a $12,500 prize for his runner-up finish. Shortly after finishing his round, Huber picked up his cell phone, checked the scores, and saw that Visaki had regained the lead. Quote, "I hit driver on almost every hole," Huber said. "I knew I needed to shoot a really low score. I was able to drive it well and make some putts. I knew I needed to make a lot of birdies, and I was hoping to make a couple more, but it was still a lot of fun." Brady Calkins from Chesaucus, Washington, also jumped into contention after shooting a sparkling 29 on the back nine Sunday. He finished at 21 under after nearly rolling in a sweeping 25-foot birdie putt on 18. It finished just short of the hole. Calkins shot a final round 64. He pocketed $9,500 for his strong third-place finish. Quote, "I had a good chance to get to 22 under," Calkins said. "The only thing I didn't want to do on that last putt was leave it short, but it did come up a little short. I got off to a slow start, but the balls started going in on the back nine. This was my first time here, and it was a fun weekend," unquote. But this day and weekend belong to Visaki as the professionals return to the Waterloo Open this year after the 2020 pro event was canceled because of the COVID pandemic. It has been a memorable year for Visaki, who gained nationwide attention after a video of him went viral and was shown on ESPN. In the video, he made an emotional call home to his family after he qualified for his first PGA Tour event. On Sunday, he pumped his right fist in celebration as his winning putt disappeared into the cup. He flashed a huge grin while signing his winning scorecard in the clubhouse after his breakthrough victory. Visaki, 27, won't have much time to celebrate. He's off to play in another qualifying event on Monday. Quote, "It's been a pretty wild and crazy year, but it's been so memorable and meaningful to me," he said. "It's so rewarding and gratifying to win a tournament like this. It's been a whirlwind, but a lot of positive things have happened in my life. It's a great feeling to pick up a win here," unquote. Now in amateur golf, a story filed by Doug Newhoff, sports correspondent. Lindemann finishes strong en route to victory. Waterloo, Dusty Drenth and Glenn Walls did what they could to keep the pressure on Trent Lindemann Sunday during the final round of the Waterloo Open Amateur Golf Tournament. Lindemann handled it like a champion. Walls and Lindemann entered the last round tied for the lead, with Drenthe just a shot behind. Two birdies on the first three holes helped Lindemann, a former Simpson College standout from New Sharon, take sole possession of the lead, but midway through his round, he found himself a shot behind. Five birdies over a six-hole stretch from the 10th through the 15th holes turned everything around, and Lindemann cruised down the stretch with a four-stroke edge that was more than enough for his first Waterloo Open title. He drained a par-saving 30-foot putt on the rolling 17th green and finished with a round of 66 for a 54-hole total of 13 under par, 203. When he woke up Sunday, he knew he had the game to bring it home. Quote, "I was a little nervous, being tied for the first time," Lindemann said, "but it felt good going into today. This weekend, it all kind of came together. This would be, really, my first Iowa tournament win. It's unbelievable. It's just an unreal feeling," unquote. Lindemann rose to the occasion when Walls and Drenthe, who opened with three straight birdies, grabbed a lead at 10 under. Drenthe reached 11 under at one point. Quote, "I knew we had par threes and short par fives coming up that I knew I could take advantage of the way I was swinging," said Lindemann. "Those holes helped me get that lead and keep it." Even with a pair of challenging par threes to finish the round, Lindemann knew the tournament was his to win. "My short game has been very, very good these past 2 weeks, so I knew I could rely on that, even if I missed those greens," he said. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, July 19th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks so much for being with us today.